In a world where God is dying, four heathens come to deliver the final nails in the coffin. From the depths of hell, Satan sends four puppets of the imperialist West and the Zionist Jews against God, Islam, and tiny kittens to bring you their propaganda and conspire for a new world order. This is Secular Jihadists from the Middle East.
Good evening, everybody, or good morning, depending on what time you're listening to this. This is Secular Jihadists from the Middle East, and today we have the usual suspects. We've got Armin Navabi, the founder of Atheist Republic, the largest online platform for atheists in the world with over 1.7 million followers right now. And he's also the author of Why There Is No God. Hello, Armin.
Hi.
And we have Yasmin Mohammed. I sound so professional right now. It's so weird. we've got Yasmin Mohammed. She's the author of Confessions of an Ex-Muslim, an upcoming book. And she also writes blogs at confessionsofanexmuslim.com. Hello, Yasmin. How are you?
Good. How are you doing? Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
The rest of you can't see her. I can. I'm privileged. It's called the Yaz privilege. And we have a guest that we're very, very excited about having right now. And he's been very generous with his time tonight. We have Ron Miscavige. And Ron Miscavige is the author of Scientology, My Son, David Miscavige, and Me. That's the title of his book. It was put out last year.
Hang on a second. It's Ruthless Scientology.
Oh, what did I say?
You just started with Scientology. That's okay. But let me give the title.
I'm sorry.
I know it. Yes. Since I wrote the book, I happen to know what the title actually is. It's called Ruthless Scientology, My Son, David Miscavige, and Me. Okay, go on, continue.
Thank you very much. Yeah, that was actually, I'm actually looking at the title right now, so I was just sort of like a mind thing where I missed that word. Anyway, this is we're familiar with the book. So the reason I'm familiar with the book is because we both have the same publisher, St. Martin's Press.
Yeah, that's right.
For my book and Ron's. And Ron is actually he was in the Church of Scientology for many, many years. He's also the father of David Miscavige, who is the current leader of the Church of Scientology. So this is going to be we have loads of questions, and we're just going to get right into it, Ron, if you don't mind. So I'm going to hand it over to Yaz. She had the very first one.
Okay, so Ron, I was hoping you could just give us a little bit of background. So you were a member of the Church of Scientology for over 40 years and a member of the Sea Org for about 26 years. Right. And you mentioned that the Sea Org was sort of like the upper echelon. Could you tell us just a little bit about the difference between the two? Thanks.
Okay, now listen, I was a member of the Church of Scientology for 42 years, but for 26 and a half of those years, that's the last 26 and a half years, I was in the Sea Organization. There's several ways you can participate in Scientology. The number one way that people start off with is as a public Scientologist. Now, that's a person who has a life in the world at large, and they buy services and they're delivered to them at the Scientology organizations. And they're called orgs for short. That's as a public Scientologist. You buy services and get it delivered to you. Another way you could do it is to join staff, and you work at those organizations and you deliver the services to the public Scientologists. And then another way you can participate would be to join the Sea Organization. Well, excuse me. Yeah, you join the Sea Organization. And there's levels of that even within the Scientology structure. The first level that you would probably go in at, if you join the Sea Organization, would be to work at an org that delivers the higher level services. And then if you want to move up, or you're asked to move up and you go into international management, then you would go to a place in Hammett, California. And there's a base there, and that base is where the management of Scientology took place for many years, and that's where David Miscavige would live when he was running the church from there, and apparently he hasn't been there for quite a few years, but those are the different levels. A public Scientologist, a staff member who delivers services. They're not in the SEA organization. They have either a 2.5 or a 5 year commitment to that. And then you join the SEA organization and there's levels within that. Now, the regular SEA org member would be like the Catholic Church has its priests. And that would be these SEA organization members who deliver services where it's higher level services to the parishioners or public Scientologists. And then the top level would be if you worked at the international base, that would be like the cardinals in Rome. And that's how it's split up. I don't know if I watched that. I'm trying to give you a little encapsulation of how it works.
That's perfect. Thank you so much. So you were part of that for a very, very long time. You mentioned 42 years?
Yes.
Altogether. And in the documentary with Leah Remini, you and Becky told us a fascinating story about how you ended up leaving the church eventually. Do you mind recapping that for us?
No, I don't mind at all. As a matter of fact, I'll tell you something. That we escaped, actually, from the church. We didn't leave. We literally had to escape. And we escaped on March 25th, 2012, all right? We had to plan that escape for about 6 months. And I go into details in this in the book, and in an interview this way, it would take 10 hours for me to tell you the whole story about now our life was in Scientology to begin with, and later on how it turned south or sour. But I'll try to be brief, but just so you get the idea of it. When we joined the SEA organization, or when I joined the SEA organization, and Becky joined a little after me, we met there and we got married while we're in the SEA organization. My entrance in the SEA organization was quite pleasant, to be quite frank with you. I mean, I joined, and because I'm a musician, I immediately went into the music area of the church, and I was a composer for various videos that we would do to be played at these international events. First thing I did, I went into a studio, and I did an album with a gentleman by the name of, I'm drawing a blank on it now. Edgar Winter. Anybody know the name Edgar Winter? Rock star in the 70s. He did the song Frankenstein. Do you know that one?
What was he in a band? I never thought I'd say this, but I think I might be too young.
You are. But that's okay. Listen, it's great to be young. I happen to be old. You know, it's good to be old, too.
Well, to somebody else, you're very young, too. So.
I turned 81 this past January, you know, so I'm still kicking. I still play a lot of gigs. Wow. But anyway, first thing I did was I did an album with Edgar Winter. Now, you work hard, and but there were nice rewards in those days. Did you ever hear of Isaac Hayes? Maybe that was the name you'd be familiar with.
Yes, mm-hmm.
I did many gigs with Isaac Hayes. So these were the enjoyable times. This was the entrance in it. But as time went on, it turned from being a hardworking, very pleasant experience into something that became intolerable for us to live that way. And we just could not live with our freedoms taken away. I'll give you an example. If you wanted to write a letter to somebody, you had to put it in an unopened envelope, an unsealed envelope. And security guards would read that. And if there was anything in there that you shouldn't be saying, it was sent back to you. You had to rewrite it until you got their permission to send it out. If you wanted to make a phone call to somebody, you had to go through a switchboard operator, and there was somebody listening in on the phone call. All right, these are basic freedoms, guys, okay?
Mm-hmm.
We couldn't leave the base to go to a store to buy some amenities in life, like a toothbrush or maybe, you know, undershirts or whatever, or socks. You had to order it from the internet, or you could buy it at the canteen they had on the base. This is how our life ended up. Just every day, waking up, going to work at 9, going to breakfast, 9 o'clock in the morning, 9:30, going to a muster, then study in the morning, 2.5 hours of study. And mostly that was indoctrination and doing, in other words, study about how to make your post more successful. And the hours that you're working, you're producing a better product. Then you'd go to lunch every day, and at 1 o'clock, you'd have a muster where you gathered and make sure everybody is there, and you'd work all afternoon. 5 o'clock, you went to dinner. 5:30, there's another muster. And then you went to work in the evening until anywhere 9, 10, 11, 12, 1, 2 o'clock in the morning. This is how our life was living. I mean, this is how we're living our life. Very regimented life.
Like military school.
No. Listen, I'm a Marine veteran. And the only thing that is that way in the Marine Corps is boot camp, okay?
Mm.
Once you get out of boot camp and you have a job, it is not like that. You do your job and you're rewarded. And if you don't do your job, you get punished. I'll take it any day, you know? And by the way, in the Marine Corps.
And nobody reads your letters when you're writing people.
Right,
letters
of course. We're on the phone. Yeah.
By the way,
and you get to speak to your children if you leave.
That's exactly right. But anyway, that led to us finally agreeing that, hey, we got to get the hell out of here. And our escape, as I say, we planned it for about 6 months. I'll give you a couple little details on it, which I think maybe your listeners would find interesting. On my birthday, my wife got together with my daughters, and she got them to give me 75 gifts for my 75th birthday.
Oh.
Now, this has part to do with the story, though. I'm not just telling you this to say something nice about my daughters. Because of that, when we were thinking about leaving, we wanted to be able to take some of this stuff with us. Because one of the things about being in the Sea Org, you get paid very little money. We got $50 a week toward the end. In the beginning, when I first joined in 1985, we were getting $30 a week. Now, you get your food, your clothing, and birthing, you know. But still, $50 a week will get you nowhere. I don't have to explain that. So we had a whole bunch of stuff that we wanted to salvage. And I could only fit so much in the car that I had. So Becky's mother's birthday was coming up. And by the way, Becky is my second wife. She's a lot younger than me. And her mother's birthday was coming up. So we decided to send her mother 70-some gifts.
Mm-hmm.
And we were sending her mother things like a detailing kit for our car, which, you know, what woman is going to want to use a detailing kit in a car? Or maybe Scientology books, and her mother's not a Scientologist. And in those days, we still were thinking that, you know, we're still going to keep our religion when we left. So that was part of our plan, to be able to send out all these gifts. And it was okay with the security guards because they saw me get 75 gifts. So they figured, okay, well, they're doing the same thing for her mother. That was part of it. But anyway.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us how the Kindle had something to do with this? Because there's a little bit of a conspiracy theory going on, because some listeners have been trying to get your book on Amazon and they can't find your book on Amazon. And they noticed that there are quite a few Church of Scientology books that are not available on Amazon. And you mentioned
like Amazon eBooks or Amazon because the actual print book.
No, if you go on Amazon, Becky, if they go on Amazon, you can get a hard what
Becky?
Wait, are you in Canada?
Maybe it's just a conspiracy theory, because you mentioned that it was that you and Becky had a Kindle and that's how you first went on the internet. And so then people thought, ooh, maybe Amazon is involved in this and maybe Amazon are Scientology people. But no, there's no truth to that.
If you go on Amazon, you can order the hardback, paperback, or a Kindle version, okay?
Okay. So why don't you tell
me? Let's go to Kindle, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, the story that you, when you were looking at the books and you went to Google by accidentally, and then you found out a lot of things about Scientology, that story, I think, yeah.
I know the story.
You just told the whole
story. I got the Kindle from David, my son. And at first, when I got it, the security guards were doing their damnedest to get it away from me. And I absolutely could not figure out why they wanted that Kindle, because the Kindle was something that he put a whole bunch of L. Ron Hubbard fiction stories on there for me. And I was interested in reading those because I like the fiction that LRH wrote. LRH is short for L. Ron Hubbard.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the things about the Kindle that I had, it was the first generation, which is a mechanical switch, where there was a little toggle switch on it that you could push to the right or the left, up, down, or in. As an example, if you were reading a book and you ran across the word that you wanted to get the meaning of. Maybe you didn't know it. You would select the word and go to the dictionary and then press it to the right, and it would say go to dictionary. I was looking up a word, and I pressed it to the right and held it there a little bit, and it went right past dictionary and went right on Google. So I was on the internet, no filter. Now, when we would go on the internet at the international base, there was a filter on there that you could not put in the name Miscavige, or you could not put in the word Scientology. That was only used if you wanted to buy something or maybe look up something pertaining to your job. So I'm on Google, and I start looking up the things about Scientology, and I see that it is not what we've been told about it. As an example, L. Ron Hubbard's war record was not what he said it was. But the main thing that really bothered me is I looked up Annie Tidman. The reason I looked her up, well, I don't know why the hell I looked her up, but I did. Right. She's a good friend of mine, and she developed lung cancer and was sent down to Los Angeles for treatment with a handler. And I would ask about her health quite a bit from the medical liaison officer. And I'd say, Martine, how is Annie doing? Oh, Ronnie, she's doing great. She's doing real good. So I look on the internet. She died 6 months earlier. Nobody on the base knew that, okay? Shortly after that, there's two girls that I saw, and they said, Ron, we're chipping in to get Annie a nice birthday present. Do you want to chip in? Now, they either knew it and they were part of the ruse, or didn't know it, and they're kept in the dark just like the rest of us. So that onion started to peeling. The skin started coming off the onion with that. And I looked up other things, and I Jesus Christ, we're living a lie.
But Ron, why would they hide her death? What would be the rationale for that?
Well, I'll tell you why. Because the technology of Scientology is supposed to be able to handle anything. So that when she went to Los Angeles, she would get treatment, but she'd also get what's called auditing. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know if you know what that is. That's the Scientology word for counseling. But it's not like counseling that you receive, let's say, in the outside world, okay? This is a specific way to have a communication with the person where you absolutely keep their attention pinpointed on what you're trying to handle. And the end result of it would be the person himself trying to, or coming to the realization that somehow they had something to do with what's wrong with them, or maybe the trauma that they're experiencing. So Annie was getting auditing down in L.A., so for them to say, okay, she died, that's not great news, you know?
Mm-hmm. So
anyway, going back to the escape, do you want to hear that rest of that?
Yes.
As long as we're on it. Well, the day that I'm leaving, the day before I'm leaving, I'm putting stuff in the car. Now, there's a saying that if you want to keep something secret, put it right out in the open. I don't know if you ever hear that.
Mm-hmm.
Put it right out in the open. So here I am. I'm taking out a mesh bag full of shoes to the car, putting it in the car, and a security guard comes down on his motorcycle. Hey, Ron, how you doing? Oh, Sal, I'm doing great, buddy. He's looking at me, putting a mesh bag full of shoes in my station wagon. Now, what the hell am I doing at maybe 9:30 at night? Didn't say anything. Then another guy is walking into the laundry room because that was where we lived. We lived across from this building, which took care of the sheets and the towels and everything that you had in the birthing. And the guy looks at me and says, Ron, how you doing? Okay. And meanwhile, I'm putting a bag full of clothes in the car. This is right out in the open. Now, the other cover I had for us planning the escape and not getting caught is that I was 76 years old and I was the father of the chairman of the board of the Church of Scientology. So that for me to do that was the unthinkable. Nobody would ever suspect that I was doing that. Next morning, we wake up, and I had a list of the things that I wanted to take in a little notebook. Must have gone through it about five times. 9 o'clock, we get in the car, and we drive. There's two exits, or two security gates at that base. And on one gate, you have the security guards where they stay. And then there's a gate about 200 yards down the road, and that's remote. And all it is there is a little TV camera that if you approach that, that camera shows you, shows the security guards who you are. And then you press a button to talk to them. On Sunday morning, though, there's only two security guards on duty. One is in the main booth, and the other one is what's called a chaser. In other words, he has a car, and he has the chase car, and he would chase somebody if they tried to escape. So now we're driving past the mess hall where people would eat, and I saw the chase car there, which was where Sal was. So I knew that we're okay for a little bit once we get out the gate. I pull up to the gate, hit the button, and at that point, if he said, come to the booth, we're screwed. Because he would have seen everything in the car. It would be caught, would be seized. You wouldn't be talking to me right now. I hit the button, and he opened the gate. But I'll tell you why he opened the gate. Part of our plan was for me to go across from the south part of the base to the north side through that gate and go to the music studio. In the music studio, there was a kitchenette there, and there was a refrigerator, and I kept Italian salami there, soppressata, maybe Parmesan cheese, a lot of little goodies. I'd go there, chop up some of this, and drive back to the main gate and give these goodies to the guards. So I conditioned them into seeing me do this route every Sunday morning.
Oh, wow.
So I'm telling you, I had to resort to this bullshit to get out.
That is a plan.
I knew. Wow. I heard that story on the documentary, but that sausage bit there that you're giving to the security guards, that was an extra bit of tidbit there.
I'll tell you, you guys listening to this, you got to get the book.
Yeah, for sure.
That escape story, I've had so many people tell me, Ron, you got to make a movie out of this. Sometimes I'll read it again and think, Jesus Christ, did we have to do that? Well, we did. So now, I'm at the gate. I press the button, no sound, the gate opens. We pulled out, I said, Becky, we're turning left. I jumped on it, and I have a station wagon, but it has double overhead cam, and it has real good pickup. I'm going 70 miles an hour down the road, and about a mile down the road, there is a road that turns to the right, which goes to Route 10. There's a road that goes straight, which goes to Route 60. And if you turn left, you go into town. I knew that once the security guard saw me leaving, he'd get on the Nextel and say, Ron, what the hell are you doing? Of course, I left my Nextel in our birthing space. And then he'd get on the phone with Sal and say, Sal, get up to the booth pronto. Sal had to get up from the breakfast table, go to the car, turn it around, go to the booth. And by the time he left the booth, I would be past those three roads. I knew that he would think he's either going on Route 10 or Route 60, because that's how you get to L.A. I turned left, went into Hemet, and up the road about another mile, there's a traffic signal. I turned to the right. That put us in the boondocks, and I knew at that point we were free. And we drove across the United States 2.5 days. I didn't use a credit card to pay for anything. I paid for gas, cash, food.
Because they could see the transactions, right?
Yeah.
That's right. They would trace my credit card and didn't know exactly where I was.
By the way, can I ask?
No. But I just want to say that your book has a lot of other stories. So this is just one of them. So I'm going to link to the book for anybody that wants to hear your full story, because there are so many other interesting stories in your book.
Yeah. But I had.
Go on, sorry.
Yeah, Ron, I just wanted to know. So, like, what would have happened if you got caught? What would have happened if they got you?
Well, we'll just sit down, have a nice steak dinner, you know, talk it out, you know, and shit like that. We would have been seized. I would have been sequestered away from my wife. She would have been taken away from me and put in separate places where we would sleep and eat. We would go under interrogation every day.
You'd go in the hole, probably.
Not necessarily. Not necessarily because of who I was, in other words. Because I'm the father of the chairman of the board, I think they would want to keep me as a separate particle, all right?
Right.
And we'd have gone interrogation every day, and when we're not being interrogated, we'd have been put on physical labor.
And there's nobody who could, there's no way anybody could help you with that outside, or?
No, you had no way. You had no way to get out. I didn't have a phone that I could call the cops or anything. I knew what I was doing. I knew that
if
I didn't make good on this, I was screwed. And I'll tell you, it's unbelievable that you have to resort to that.
Mm.
This is why I wrote the book. Look, guys, my family was taken away from me. And they disconnected from me. Now, here's the thing, and here's how this works. You do something like I did, and you're considered to be a suppressive person. They will then get your family to disconnect from you. At first, when I got out, I used to talk to my daughters just about every day. That went on for a month or so with one daughter, and then she stopped talking to me, and my other daughter, up until Father's Day in June, sent me a beautiful card, and that was the end of her being in communication with me. Now, if they don't do that, they're considered to be also suppressives. Their family will disconnect from them. If you work for a Scientology employer, you'll lose your job. He has to fire you. Even though they're not the ones who escape, but just by merely talking to me, they would receive the same punishment as me, and that would be the disconnect. And quite frankly, guys, that's the main reason I wrote the book, because of the disconnection policy, because they destroy families. There's no two ways about it.
Just like a lot of other religions that destroy family and disconnect people.
Right.
Right.
But I don't know if they do it with the same ferociousness that the church does. I mean, look. I was raised a Catholic, and truly, when I was a little kid, I enjoyed going to confession, and I'll tell you why. We had a priest that was from Poland. He understood about half of what you told him, okay? So as a little kid, I'd go in there and I'd tell him my sins, and he'd say, okay, say 5 Our Fathers and 5 Hail Marys, you're forgiven. And I'd walk out and I think, man, I got a clean slate, you know, I'm going to try to be a better kid and blah, blah, blah. And by the way, the line to his confessional booth was jammed. And the other priest would give you a goddamn lecture. Nobody was there. They didn't want to get a lecture. So now, with the church, you're getting interrogated. They have a digital voice recorder on what you're saying, and they have a TV camera aimed at your face and at the e-meter, which is used to detect anything you might be holding out on. That priest didn't say to me, well, I'll tell you what, Ronnie, I forgive you, but if you ever go against us, we're going to slam you. We're going to put hate sites up on you like they did to me. There's over 500 iterations of my name that was bought by the church, so that no matter how you put in my name, you're going to be taken to a hate site. And if you read what they have to say about me, I should have been shot yesterday, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But this is what they do. This is their standard operating. They character assassinate you. If anybody wants to get in touch with me, or for any reason, you go on therealronmiscavige.com. That's called therealronmiscavige.com. That's my website. You can get in touch with me. I do talks.
I will link to that in the so anybody can click on it. And not to any of those fake ones that they made of you. We actually can relate to you a little bit more than ex-Catholics or other ex-Christians, because a lot of ex-Muslims, they're, you know, the punishment for us is death for leaving Islam, right? And a lot of ex-Muslims also get shunned by their family, and a lot of parents basically kick them out, or so it's pretty harsh. But one thing I
meant, if I could just add one more thing, Armin, I just wanted to say that there are 13 countries that actually will, the death penalty is applied to people that leave Islam.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. But listen, that's the way it is. You got to face it. It isn't make believe. You guys aren't lying. It is the way it is.
Right. But I was going to make another comparison with Scientology, and I was going to see if this is true about Islam. I was going to see if it's true also about Scientology. A lot of people are always shocked how Muslims could believe or other religious people could believe in the things that they believe. And when you also look at Scientology, there's so much wacky stuff in there, and people are like, how could people believe in this? But I remember there was this hadith about Abu Bakr, which is the first Khalifa of Muslims. They asked, when Muhammad claimed that he went to heaven from Jerusalem, and he went and met the prophets, people came to Abu Bakr and asked him, do you really believe this? Do you really believe that he actually went on a horse and went to heaven? And Abu Bakr said, you know what? We already believe so much of what he said. We believe that he speaks to God, to angels. We believe this and that. So what is this? This is nothing. Like, this is nothing compared to all the things that he said. So, and I think the way it works with many religions, just like Islam, is that you start accepting things. And then once you keep accepting, and then slowly it gets more ridiculous. But because you have been in the habit of believing in things, then at some point you're so deep in that you're not ready to deny anything that, you know, that's why they don't
you're conditioned.
That's why they don't give you the Zunu stuff at the beginning, only once you're so deep in that, right? Is that how it works?
That's how indoctrination works.
I couldn't say it better, I'll be honest with you. That's exactly right. It ain't close. It's exactly right, okay? Now, I'll add something to that, though, and that's this. In Scientology, and by the way, help has a lot to do with a person staying in Scientology. Just remember that, and I'll get back to it, okay? Help. Mm-hmm. Now, when you first get in Scientology, and this is, you refer to it as the bottom of the bridge, because the whole experience in Scientology is called the bridge to total freedom, all right? Mm-hmm. Which is not quite true, okay?
to say the least.
When I say that, okay? But the beginning, at the bottom of the bridge, there is data, there is knowledge that you can partake in that will improve your life. And I'll give you one example, and that's the actual formula for communication. This is one of the first things you do is a communication course. And by learning this and then going out into life and doing this in your job or your personal relationship with people, you see that you do improve your life. There's no two ways about it. So that because of that, you feel, hey, this is the real good. This is the real good stuff. This is good. The next thing would be maybe how you could divide your life into 8 different parts and utilize that to see where you're doing good, where you're not doing that great, and how to improve that. And you can utilize that tool. And then there's also other information about affinity, reality, and communication equal understanding. I'll give you an example of that. Now, are any of you pro football fans? You follow pro football?
I'm actually supposed to, because I lived in Buffalo for 5 years, and it was almost blasphemous not to be into football. But unfortunately, I wasn't.
You have to follow the Bills, but I'm going to use it as an example because I'm sure you can relate to it. Let's say you met somebody, and now ARC, affinity, reality, communication. You start talking to this person, and you know, you find out that he's a Buffalo Bills fan, and you are too. So you have a common reality. You follow that?
Yep. So
by communicating, you come up with maybe things that you have in common. Because of that, you have a tendency to like that person a little better. Your affinity level for that person goes up. So between communicating the fact that you're a Buffalo Bills fan and he is, you have a common reality, you're getting to like that person better because, hey, he's a Buffalo Bills fan. You could say you understand him a little better. So there you can see a little example of affinity, reality, and communication will equal understanding. Mm-hmm. This is a commonly used tool by anybody who first comes in, and you see that this works. But by agreeing to these things, you're setting up little points of agreement. So as you said, later on, when you are given this stuff that doesn't quite make sense, you accept it, because at first you says, well, everything they told me so far is true. I'll just accept this.
Right.
And I gave you the example, although I really didn't even have to, because the way you said it was perfectly true. So let's put it this way. those things that are promised later on, such as supernatural abilities, have never been delivered to one person. And I was involved with the church for 42 years. I never met one person who achieved it. I'll give an example. The fact that you could leave your body as a spiritual being and go to another town and read a newspaper there, that would be a supernatural ability. I never saw one person who ever achieved that in all the time I was in. I did see people improve their communication skills, these bottom of the bridge things. And I said this many times, as a matter of fact, I say in the book, that if they were to cut back, well, there's no way to save them at this point. They're like the fucking Titanic going down. You have to flip that out, or are we okay with that?
Oh, yeah, we're okay with that. We're okay.
Okay, all right. Look, if they were to cut back just to those things that did work, change prices so people could afford it, because right now, what I did in the early years in Scientology would cost about $4,000 or $5,000. These days, for those same services, you're talking about maybe $250,000. So cut the prices back to what people can afford. Give services that actually work and improve people's lives. Give a general forgiveness, a general amnesty, and knock out disconnection. They might have a chance of surviving. The odds of that happening would be the same odds as me turning into a pelican as in the middle of a statement to you guys, okay? It ain't going to fucking happen, all right?
Yeah, I could do this for ages.
Yeah, there you go.
So, sorry, Yaz, did you have the question, or should I? Why don't you go ahead, and I'll ask mine after.
No, go ahead, Ali.
Okay, so, yeah, Ron, I just wanted to kind of, I mean, obviously the story is amazing, and I have to, as you said, there's so much more in the book that I think a lot of people listening to this are going to go out and buy it, because I certainly am. But I just want to know the relationship with you and your son. I mean, when you first got into Scientology, how is it that? How did it? How do you feel about it now? How do you feel about it then? How did you feel about it then? How did that sort of deteriorate the way it has?
Well, you say when I first got into Scientology. No, I got him. I got my whole family in Scientology.
Yeah, you did. Yeah.
All right. And the way it happened is that, I might as well tell you the story because it's pretty interesting. I have a friend, Nelson Sandy, and Nelson Sandy is now, that name is known all over the world because I've done interviews all over. He's a fellow musician. Well, he's a singer. And mm-hmm. I guess you'd call him a musician, but I don't call singers musicians.
Oh, anyway, ouch. I'm actually a singer in a band as well, and so that hurts. But it's okay. It's okay.
That's not even a disparagement of you. It's just that an old habit. The guys, you know, when I was growing up, and they'd say, "What do you got in your band?" We said, "Three musicians and a singer." I'm telling you, that's what they would say. Anyway, Nelson, he's a good singer, and he said to me one time, "Ron, I used to be a doctor, but I lost my patience." Now that's in the '60s. It's still funny. Matter of fact, we're doing a gig one time in Greenwood Lakes, New York. We come off the bandstand, and the guy came over to the bar where we were standing and said, "Nelson, you're a great singer. Can I buy you a drink?" He said, "No, but can I have the money?" He was always quick on the update, right? Nelson Sandy said to me one day, "Ron, how would you like to make an extra $100,000? I said, "Great." Mm-hmm. He introduced me to a multi-level marketing scheme called Holiday Magic. I got into it, and there was four of us that got together, and we would go around and set up these opportunity meetings and get other people to buy in. You know what I mean by multi-level, like a mm-hmm. pyramid?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. You know, like Amway.
Yeah, like
pyramid, yeah. It doesn't work, but it sounds good, all right? And people get involved, and they lose money. But, you know, what the hell? I was willing to take a chance at it. I didn't see that was happening to us. I'm going to... opportunity meeting one day, and a guy standing next to me says, "I'm a Scientologist." And I says, "Hang on a second, what is that?" I actually pinned him down and made him tell me about Scientology for about 30 minutes. It interested me. And I started going to a place in Woodbury, New Jersey, called Frank Ogle's Cafeteria. And on every Tuesday or Wednesday night, he would have a little meeting with people and give them little tidbits of Scientology that you could go out and practice. I found it very interesting. And about after 3 or 4 weeks, I figured I had it down. I left. Now, getting back to David. Okay, because this is what you asked me about. And by the way, Yasmin is off the screen. Is there a problem there?
Where did I go?
I don't know, but you're there though, right?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, she's there.
Okay, good. I just don't see you. Now you're back. All right. Okay. So David was born with a severe case of asthma. I mean, it was pitiful because as a little baby, sometimes I would wonder, is he going to catch his next breath? I don't know if you ever saw a little kid have an asthmatic attack, but
yeah,
it was the bane of his existence. All my other kids were healthy and strong. He was strong, but this was killing him. I tried many different unusual solutions to try to handle it. Getting back to this story, I thought, you know what? I'm going to see if Frank Ogle can audit David and maybe help him with his asthma. Now, I explained auditing, didn't I? Way of counseling people. So I took David down to Frank Ogle's place and said, Frank, could you give David a session? Took him in. 45 minutes later, David came out smiling. I said, how's it going? He said, Dad, I'm handled. And we never had a severe asthmatic attack as a little kid. He had some attacks, but it was never as severe. Now, to me, I saw that happen to him. I think it was a real epiphany for him. He thought, this is something I got to do something with. And for me, I thought, you know what? I want my whole family to do this.
How old was he at the time?
Let's see. He would have been about 9 years old.
Okay.
9 years old. And I'll tell you, it was something because, oh, Christ. I tell the story. I might as well tell you guys. I would try anything to help him out of an attack. And one winter, I'm living in New Jersey. One winter, he's having a very bad attack, and I take him upstairs, a little kid. I took off his clothes, took off my clothes, went in the shower with him, turned on the warm water. I said, Dave, I'm not trying to punish you because I'm here with you. Turned off the hot water. That water come out like ice cubes. It kicked in his breathing, and he started breathing, and I rubbed him down with a Turkish towel. That's the shit I used to do, try to help him. So when I saw that that auditing helped him, I thought, you know, I want my whole family to do this. And that kind of sealed it for us getting in Scientology. And I got my whole family. And then, as a matter of fact, I went to England twice for a year and 3 months, 72 to 73, and then 74 to 75. And I put him on the bridge, and we just studied Scientology for like 2.5 years. So, listen, I was a real Kool-Aid drinker. I got a lot of people in, and, you know, to me it was everything. But the further I was in it, the further you find out all is not well in Rome, you know?
And how did... Thing with
the, go on.
Sorry, just to continue on that part of the question, how did... did David have any idea that you're moving away from it? Did you, or was it just like a really sudden thing where you left one day and he had no, how did that dynamic play out over time?
Well, he didn't know I was leaving, and because I kept it from him. But I'll tell you, with the way I mentioned earlier about your male being, you know, opened up, also coming to you, you never got a letter that wasn't open. They'd open up your mail before you got it, read it.
Yeah,
and about not being able to leave the base to go off shopping or not being able to make phone calls. But one of the main things that happened to me toward the very end was this. I worked in the music area, and we got a new music director. And no matter what I wrote, it would get rejected. So I would go to work every day, write music every day, every week, every month. Everything I wrote was rejected. I finally sent him a note and said, Dave, I got to talk to you. So we got together and I said, listen, David, I can't live this way. I go to work every day, week in, month out, and I fail. Please give me another job. I said, I will take a job waxing cars in Motor Pool. And he says, okay, I'll look into it. Well, he never looked into it. He never got back to me. And then one day I said to Becky, look, I can't live this way any longer. There's no way I'm going to live the rest of my life this way. So he did not know where we were going to go because I kept it concealed. If he knew I was going to go, I wouldn't be here talking to you right now.
Mm-hmm. So Armin kind of mentioned that there are a lot of similarities that we see between Islam and Scientology. And I'm just going to ask you one more question about Dave before we move on, which I know that probably you get a lot of questions about him. But, you know, there's generally a very sinister, like there's a negative, people have a negative impression of David Miscavige, right? He basically systematically got rid of everybody so that he could take the place of LRH and, you know, LOP and things like that. So I just wanted to ask you, because I was married to a jihadi. I was married to a member of Al-Qaeda. So I was married to a horrible human being. But what is hard to explain sometimes is that when there's somebody that is capable of doing such horrible things, but they really honestly and truly do believe that they're doing it for the right reasons. They think that they're doing good, and they don't realize the evil that they're doing because in their own minds, you know, they think it's good. So I'm wondering, do you think that it's the same way for David? Do you think that it's a case of absolute power corrupts absolutely, and that he's just, you know, power's all gone to his head? Or do you think that he really does think that he's helping the world?
You know, it's a tough question. As someone who was a little baby, you know, I changed his diapers. I mean, I enjoyed his friendship as a little kid. You just don't toss that out. I mean, he and I got along great when he was a little boy. I taught all of my kids how to swim, you know. When they're 3 years old, they could dive off a 3-meter board. When they're 4, the boys played football. They helped me around the house. They had little projects we do together. So it's hard just to say he's a bastard from the word go, because that's not true. But you mentioned something, that power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. By the way, that was Lord Acton that said that. I don't know whether you knew that or not. No. But he was a member of the British Parliament in the 1800s. And he's the one that said, power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. He also said this, which many people have never heard. Great men tend to be bad men. Mm. You can look that up on the internet. That is a great site. But now look, I do think that the power has corrupted him in soft moments where the real person shines through. I'll give you just an example. As a matter of fact, I don't know if I ever told this before. We were on the Free Winds ship. Have you ever heard of the Free Winds ship? It's a ship that the church owns.
Yep.
And you go there for your upper level OT8, which is the top of the bridge. And we also would go there for a maiden voyage anniversary cruise every year. That ship sailed in 1988. And then every year after that, the same month, you'd go on an anniversary cruise. While we're on that cruise, the band would perform different shows and stuff. And one day, we're setting up for this show, we're rehearsing for it, and the band is behind these curtains, and it's dark behind the curtains, and in a certain signal, and I was the band leader at the time, I would bring the band in, and they'd start playing as like an intro for somebody, and the curtain would open. So I bent over because I dropped something. I hit my head on a microphone and it cut it open, and my face was bleeding. So I heard the signal. I brought the band in and the curtain opened up, and David sees me bleeding. He said, "Oh my God, what happened to you?" And for that second, that love came through. There were other times too, when I got sick, ended up in a hospital, and he'd make a point to see me. So it's these moments that it's hard for me to say that he's no fucking good at all. That's not true. Truthfully, I want to tell you something. David is a brilliant person. He's very intelligent. If he would not have gone into Scientology and he did something else, I think he could have done a similar thing and risen to the top of just about any company. But that power, I'm telling you, man, it's like crack cocaine. You get it. You don't want to give it up. And it does change a person. And he's been, you know, brutal to people. Maybe that's the way you have to be to have something like this stay in existence. I don't know. It doesn't seem like it should be that way. But a lot of these leaders, end up being pretty bad guys. Do you know that?
Well,
you,
yeah, you that's true.
Yeah. So, do I think he thinks he's doing good? Yes, I do. Like, as an example, he, of course, he can't not know that there is certain things that can't be delivered. He's too bright to not know that. Like, to achieve these superhuman powers, it's never happened. So now what he's doing with the people who are on this bridge is recycling them down to the beginning and having them do the whole thing
right.
over.
Yeah.
And it could be that he's buying time, mm-hmm. figuring that maybe...
And making money in that process, too.
Well, that's true. There's no two ways about it. The church has a ton of money. Mm-hmm. People say to me, you know, why don't you sue them for slander? Let me tell you something. If I lived for two more lifetimes, we would never go to court. They have so many fucking attorneys, and they have hot and cold water running out of money running out of the spigots. They could put off any justice being done forever.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, getting back to how the church is being run now, it's absolutely a money-making operation. That's all it is. They keep on getting donations. Like, in the beginning, when I first got in, the whole idea was to make people into auditors so they could help other people. These days, all of it is to buy new buildings, to buy new ideal orgs, or to build up a war chest. And this is what they do all the time. So it's a money-making lit. It's a cult disguised as a religion operating as a business. Maybe so. I mean, look, the Catholic Church used to sell indulgences. Mm-hmm. You know what that is. Mm-hmm. If you gave money, they'd promise you went to heaven. Now, the good thing about it is no complaints. Nobody ever come back and says, hey, wait a minute.
I want my money back.
What the fuck is this? I didn't go to heaven. So they had a track record of 100%, right?
Right. So talking about other religions, it seems like the way you're explaining Scientology works is basically other religions also start with just a lot of good shit and messages. Like Islam starts with, we're going to take care of the orphans, but then it's like, oh, let's kill the non-believers. Christianity is like, love your neighbors. Oh, and also give us 10% of your income. Like starts with the they suck you in with all the lovey, you know, flowery messages. And then once you get in, then you'll discover the evil side of it. Right. You know, and another thing is that the Scientology, Church of Scientology used to have 100,000 members. Right now, I think it's about 20,000. So they lost 88% of their membership. But is it possible, instead of leaving Scientology, for people to reform it to the original version of it being about the good stuff, about the communication skill, meditation? Is it a chance for that? And if there's not, why don't you think?
Okay. Yeah, there's a chance for anything, okay? But it's pretty slim, I can tell you, because you have something going right now. Look, let's get back to this power thing. Once you get it, you don't want to give it up. Yeah. You're not going to say, screw it. You know, we're going to, instead of charging you $250,000, we'll give it to you for $1,000. It's not going to happen. And they would have to cut it back to where the average working man, in other words, the guy who works for a living, has enough available funds to avail himself of this. I don't see it happening, although I tell in the book certain points that I feel if were to happen, they could salvage what they have right now. But we're talking about how many angels dance on the head of a pin. It's a useless conversation. I said earlier about health was a big deal, right? Most of the people who have stayed in Scientology, first of all, they came in to get their personal health. There was something in their life that they would like to change for the better that was ruining their life, so to speak. Once they saw that that was kind of delivered or pretty much delivered, then they wanted to help other people, so they got them to join the religion. It's all based on help, okay? And the people who have done this, some of them have been around 20 or 30 or 40 years. For them to say, hey, I think it's a bunch of crap, that's a lot of crow to eat. That's a lot for you to say, I've been duped and I wasted a good portion of my life. But in order to be free, you're going to have to give up that. You just can't keep on saying, it's going to happen, because then you turn into the jackass with a stick hanging off his head and a carrot, which he's never going to hit. You know, and man is a little more intelligent than that, but his desire to be right, I think, is what keeps a lot of people in. They can't just own up and say, you know what, I was conned.
So your solution is not to, you know, make Scientology better, but to free people from Scientology.
That would be it in a nutshell. And I can tell you, if I knew then what I know now, I would have never gotten my family in. I can tell you that. And I think it would have been a different life, but it is what it is. Look, for me to sit around thinking I've been wronged and go into a victim, no, doesn't do a goddamn bit of good. But I'll tell you what does a bit of good, talking about it, and hopefully somewhere along the way, some people will say I was going to do it. Yeah, no, I'm not going to do it. Or maybe somebody who's in right now, hearing me speak and say, you know what, I'm getting out. I have to give up certain things. I have to let go of certain things in order to get out. You remember that little story I told at the Mythicist thing about how to trap a monkey? Mm-hmm. You want me to tell that? Because I think it's...
Sure.
Yeah, please tell it. Tell it here for people
who haven't. Not everybody was there, you know. Look, here's how you trap a monkey. And this is true, by the way. It's not something I made up to make a point. You drive a stake in the ground in an opening, like a clearing, and you tie a rope around that stake, and then you take a coconut and you drill a hole in both sides. Then in the bottom hole, you pull the rope through, tie a big knot in it, so that now the rope is fastened to the stake and the knot is preventing the rope from leaving go of the coconut. You follow me so far?
Yep.
Okay, and in the upper end, you make a hole big enough for a monkey, if he put his fingers all together, could stick it through the hole, but if he made a fist, he couldn't get it back out of the hole. And what you do is you put in there some little tidbit, like some rice or a piece of fruit or something. Now, the people who set this up are hiding in the woods, so the monkey comes and his curiosity gets the best of me, looks in at the coconut, sticks his hand in, grabs that in there, try to get it out, and at that very moment, all these people start screaming and yelling, and the monkey now is jumping up and down and screaming and yelling. His hand is holding on to the little tidbit. It can't come through the hole, so he's trapped himself. They take the monkey, and they put him under a table with his skull sticking up in the top, cut off the top of his head, and eat his brains. If the monkey let go of that, he could have been free. And if you're willing to let go of those things that you hold, you think dear to your heart in Scientology, and saying, I'm leaving, you too could be free. And that's what Becky and I had to do, except for a car full of stuff and stuff that we sent to her mother. And that allowed us to be free. We had to give up friendship. We had to give up friends that we would love to still talk to. And the potential of losing my family, which I did lose, that was the price.
And you still don't know how many great grandkids you have or how many grandkids?
I don't. I actually don't. And boy, I tell you, I had some fun times with my grandchildren and my daughters. Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm.
Well, hopefully, I mean, there's still hope, right? There's still hope that they can see the light and get themselves free.
I'll tell you what, that candle's burning pretty dim, or the flame's pretty low. Because I'll tell you this, the longer you're in there, the more solidified you get on thinking you're doing the right thing, that you shouldn't speak to me because I left, and the only reason the person left, listen to this, the only reason the person leaves is because they did bad things to the organization, and they want to withdraw themselves from the organization. So they stop doing bad things against that organization. No matter how bad you treat it, but it's the things that you did bad that made you want to leave.
Yeah, same thing they say about us.
Mm-hmm.
Ex-Muslims. As ex-Muslims, we are supposed to be killed because they consider us, suppressive people. Same sort of idea. We're criminals. We betrayed the Islam. Like, we're... they just see us as like if they let us live, we're only going to cause problems for the rest of Muslims. So they have to get rid of us. Yeah,
that's wild. That's terrible, actually.
Yeah, it is really terrible. And what is the worst part of it is when we speak out about the terrible things in our religion and what it does to Muslims, we get told that we are being bigots or that we're being Islamophobic is the common term that's used now, which basically suppresses people from criticizing this religion. And you know, people can criticize Catholicism all they want. They can criticize Christianity in general, and nobody's going to call them a Christianophobic. And I'd assume with all your criticisms of Scientology, nobody has ever called you Scientologist phobic before?
They might not call me that, but they consider me a bad guy.
So anybody Scientologists consider you a bad guy, or the regular non-Scientologist people also attack you?
When you say non-Scientology, you're talking about people who left?
No, I'm just talking about average individuals who've never been Scientologists and who are just like general public. And when you talk about the Church of Scientology, do they ever attack you for saying, like, why are you being bigoted against this church? Why are you saying bad things about this church?
Not one time ever.
Yeah.
Not
one time ever. As a matter of fact, I've never met anybody who I told a story to that said anything bad about me, but they agreed with me that the Church of Scientology was bad. Their public relations is about the same as maybe a Ku Klux Klan. I don't know. It could be worse.
Well, yeah, I think you're, but that is a kind of association. But that's the thing with, I think, with when you have like the major religions, for example, with us, I mean, even a lot of non-Muslim Westerners, well, you know, if we criticize Islam, which actually has, there are a lot of, I mean, you know, you're talking about planning your escape. I mean, we talked on our podcast to a girl named Rana who was in Saudi Arabia over there. If you leave Islam, you get killed for it. One of our friends, Raif Balawi, is actually in jail in Saudi Arabia right now because he criticized, he was talking about secularism there. So it's sort of similar, but it works on the level of countries. So we had... But, you know, when they come here and they speak, so she actually had to plot her escape and run off to Germany, and her brothers had tried to follow her to try and kill her. She finally made it out. But the thing is that when you criticize the Islamic religion, there's some of the same absurdities in it that are in the other religion or in Scientology. Some you know, the stories are all really crazy for all of these religions. You do tend to... We get called bigots, and we get called people who are Islamophobic, and, you know, why are you criticizing the religion, and so on. But it is fascinating. I think that the parallels, I mean, your story is just amazing, and I think that Yaz especially can, you know, relate to parts of it in ways that all of us can in ways that...
We are trying to get more people convinced to put Islam in the same category as Scientology and the KKK.
Well, it's tough, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's very tough. It's tough to break out of these things. It's indoctrination. It's all around.
Totally indoctrination. It's total indoctrination. You know, and the thing is, with Scientology, you go and study 2.5 hours a day. You're being indoctrinated daily.
Yeah. And Muslims have to pray 5 times a day. Same sort of thing. they can't let you have more than a couple of hours without indoctrination. Yeah. So I think that Ron Miscavige studied Islam. Or not, sorry, not Ron Miscavige. I'm sorry. L. Ron Hubbard. I think that he actually studied Islam.
Ron, if your son David could listen to you right now, if he was listening to you right now, what would you tell him?
This is asked me by other people. I don't know what I would tell him. I would tell him, listen, we got to get back in communication. We just can't let this go this way. That's the main thing. Because as far as I'm concerned, communication is the universal solvent. I don't know if you'd agree with that, but I think there's
100%.
There's not anything that you can't resolve with communication. And that is the one thing that L. Ron Hubbard said. If you have a problem, keep talking. It might get worse for a while, but if you keep talking, you absolutely can resolve it. There'll be some point of agreement or some point of resolution, but that's impossible because if you're a Scientologist, you have fixed ideas, and this cuts you off from the fruit of observation as to what's real. If you have fixed ideas about things, you can't go any further than your fixed ideas will let you go.
Didn't Elrond also say the best way to make money is to start a religion?
It's been attributed to him, and I don't doubt that. I don't doubt that at all. But I never heard it.
Yeah. Ron,
let's put it this way. You know as much about it as I do, but I wouldn't doubt that happened because he did start a religion and he made a lot of goddamn money. Yeah. Now, there's a guy, if you were to listen to his lectures, he is very charismatic and absolutely, you're enthralled by him. He's such a great speaker in many subjects.
I think
the guy was not a dummy.
Yeah.
You can't get, you know, this many people to follow you around, especially join you and go around the world in a ship, you know. Jesus Christ, you got to have something on the ball to do that.
Yeah, same with Muhammad and Hitler were the same.
Yeah, but the thing
all
is...
Of them. I mean, Jesus was a hell of a demagogue.
Yeah, but how do you know? Nobody wrote anything about him for a couple hundred years. How do you know?
Yeah, that's why I didn't say Jesus, because I don't know how...
Well, we don't even know if Jesus existed, actually.
Yeah, that's why I said Muhammad and Hitler.
But you are right, Ron, for sure. All of the cult leaders and religious leaders, they have to be very charismatic in order to get all those people to follow them.
L. Ron Hubbard did give some good salient ways to run your life that if you follow and especially communication. This is the one thing. If you were to, you know, learn this and forget about being a Scientologist or that he said it, just practice those things on exactly what is a communication cycle. And if you were to exercise that in your life, you're going to find out that you're doing better in life. If you ditched everything else about Scientology and that's the only thing you got out of it, it would help you.
Isn't that the problem with religions, the good parts of it? Because that's the hook, that's the PR front of it. Like, because these good things in religion, they could come outside of religion. But the problem with the good parts of the religion is that they're the excuse for the evil parts of the religion.
They're the goodies in the coconut that you grab and you can't let go of.
No, you're right. Listen, I said, if I were to start a religion, I'll tell you what I would do. I would have only 3 points, okay? And that is this, point number one, help something. In other words, like feed the birds, or maybe if your lawn needs fertilizer, put it on it, or water the lawn. Help something. Beautify your house, okay? That's help something. Number two, help somebody. Maybe you see somebody a little bit down and out. What's wrong with giving them a hand? Or maybe giving them a job, or a little kid wants to get a question answered, help them. And number three, don't send me any money. Those are the 3 points. Now, I don't even have to start that religion. Most people are that way. Look, we feed the birds. As a matter of fact, I bought a whole big bag of rabbit food. They wouldn't eat the goddamn rabbit food. They eat bird food. And one day my wife saw me in the garage and she's sitting in a chair and the rabbit jumps in the room, a wild rabbit, and looks at her like, where's my food?
Aww.
So, and we see birds and, you know, and we help people. I donate to charities here, especially ones that, as a matter of fact, there's one in Milwaukee called Milwaukee Rescue Mission. And I had an idea that a rescue mission was like you see in a Charles Bronson movie where, you know, you're going down to Hollywood and there's a guy laying on the ground drinking a bottle of wine and they're singing holy songs in there. This isn't that way. They take people in who are down and out, but they also teach them a job.
Mm-hmm.
They have like 2 or 3 floors in the building where they teach people computer skills, or they can go out and get a job and help themselves. There are women who leave a hospital with a baby and have no fucking place to go. They take them in. They help the little kid. They help the woman. They help her get a job. Now, I'll support things like that because I think that's real help.
Yeah.
You want to call that a religion? Fine. But it already exists.
Mm-hmm.
People are basically good, except for a very small percentage. And unfortunately, the squeaky wheel gets the oil.
Totally agree.
Yeah.
And that small percentage take advantage of the good hearts of the many.
Who was it said? Who was it that said, "Doing good is my religion, and the whole world is my country"?
Wait, did you say that again?
I think there was a quote. I don't know who said it. Is it, "Doing good is my religion, and humanity, the world is my country"? Or something like that.
Well, that makes sense, doesn't it? That makes sense. But I'm going to add one, and that has nothing to do with what you just said, and that is this. Mark Twain says, it's easier to fool people than to convince them they've been fooled.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That I'm finding a very hard time doing.
Oh, man, we are right there with you, Ron. That's exactly what we do with this podcast.
Yep. Yeah.
And people just don't want to admit it. They just like that monkey analogy. They don't want to let go. They just don't want to admit to themselves that they've been fooled. And they're actually, yeah, they're ruining their own lives. They're the ones that have the power to save themselves. You know,
yeah.
It's unfortunate.
We have to make skepticism cool again.
Yeah.
Or cool for the first time. Actually.
Make skepticism great again. We need to put that on hats made in China.
Listen, if something sounds too good to be true, it probably isn't true, okay?
Yeah.
Many
religions that are promising you things that can't be delivered. Show me somebody who it was delivered to and let me speak to them. You know, that's what I say.
Yeah.
I've seen things that we call it paranormal. So I think certain things are possible. I don't know how to do it. I'll give you an example. And this actually did happen. I was at One Cherry Hill, which is the building where I first took my family to do Scientology. And it was on the 8th or 9th floor of that building. And there was a girl in an auditing session. Her name was Renata Fisher. She came running out of the session and said to the mission holder, "Give me the key to the woman's room. I got to go to the bathroom." He handed her the key. It was in a hallway, and you had to unlock a door with a special key. So she went, opened the door, went to the bathroom, came out, put the key back in his hand, and ran back in session. He looked at the key, and he said, "This is the men's room key." Now, he walked out with the key in his hand, went to the women's room door, put it in, and it would not open the door. Her taking that with the absolute certainty that that was going to work, that absolute positive mental attitude, opened the fucking door with the wrong key. Things like that are possible. I don't know how to make it work, though.
It's strange to me that if the spiritual world wants to get intervene with the natural world, it chooses to open the door to the men's room. So, in the spirit of skepticism, I hope that we also are skeptical and assume that there might be a natural explanation for what happened.
Yeah, there could be.
No, what I'm saying is this: I'm not talking about anything spiritual about that. I'm talking about the state of her mind was so positive that that was going to work. That positive attitude opened the door. I don't know how to do it myself. I couldn't do it. He couldn't do it. But the key didn't leave his hand. So that's why I say that's something I observed, and I don't know how it was done.
There's a lot of things like that that happen in this world that we can't explain. And I think the problem is when people try to explain it with lies and bullshit, and those lies and bullshits include people, you know, losing their families, that's when it becomes problematic.
Yeah, the idea is
nothing wrong with saying we don't know.
Right. Yeah. You question it. You go and you try to find out. That's the whole nature of inquiry. But Ron, we're coming up to, I think, an hour and 15 minutes. We could go on for ages just listening to you, but we know it's late for you right now, so we're going to let you go. But wow, I mean, what an amazing story. And thank you so much for talking to us.
Go get everyone listening. The book is amazing. Go check it out. And you should start a YouTube channel with all the advice, like, regards to, you know, the advice that you have. Do you have a YouTube channel already?
Oh. The website is therealronmiscavige.com.
Okay,
thank you.
I did that because people can get in touch with me, and I do events where I speak at libraries or I speak at groups, and right. I'm very happy to go just about any place to do this, but you got to get in touch, and you can get in touch with my manager that way and set it up, and I'd love to do it. But before we end off, where are you reaching me from? Where are you physically located?
I can't tell you that.
No, we're just joking.
We're just kidding. I'm actually in Canada. Armin and I are both in the west coast of Canada, in Vancouver, and Ali is in Toronto, is the east coast of Canada. So you're actually speaking to three Canadians right now. Faisal is the only American. Yay, that's right.
you know how they spell Canada, right? It's C-A-N-A-D-A. Yeah.
Yeah. Listen, I've been to Toronto on Yonge Street, and I swear to God, if you had a kite and a pair of inline skates and with that wind coming off the lake, it would take you about 30 miles up the street.
Yeah, it is. It's kind of windy. It's like
the longest street in the world, as far as I know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's a good city. And next time you come here, just let us know ahead of time, and we'll definitely meet.
There's a place in Milwaukee where I get poutine.
Oh.
Poutine. So you're making me hungry Canadian now food. At this time.
Yeah, I know.
With some mousse on top.
We're not talking about the Russian president, by the way, for all of the Trump people out there. We're talking about a food, a delicious Canadian staple. So
it's great, yeah. I love it. But anyway, listen, I'd appreciate it if people were to buy the book. And I'll tell you what, do me a favor, read the book and then see if you can loan it out to three or four other people to read, because I'm anxious just to get this out. And, you know, if those people like the idea of doing that, maybe they'll get a copy and start loaning it out. And instead of having 600,000 books, maybe we can just get 100,000 out, but 600,000 people will read it, because it is the dissemination of this cult that I really want to get out.
I'm really glad that your son-in-law ticked you off that day and that you decided to actually write this book, because it's a gift to all of us that you made that decision.
Yeah, so if you're a student club or any other event organizer, this would be a great opportunity to have like run and have some book signing sessions. I think it would, I mean, anybody that has listened to any of your interviews, they loved it. So I think this would be a great opportunity for anybody. So I'll link to the website and also to the book in the description for this.
Yeah. And Ron, last thing, if there is anybody out there who is kind of trapped, who is like, you know, how you were on that base, and if they want to communicate with you, would they be able to? Is there any way they can get in touch with you?
Yeah.
Here's the website.
Go on the website. TheRealRonMiscavige.com. TheRealRonMiscavige.com. And then call, and then I'll get in touch with them, and I'd love to talk to them, you know. But okay. I mean, see, if you want me to come and speak, I'm more than happy to do it. Because listen, I do music for fun. This is my, what do you call it? Crusade, whatever word you want to use.
It's your passion, probably.
It is a passion. Yeah, I don't want to use the word crusade because, well, I'll tell you, that was another nutty fucking thing.
And if the Church of Scientology is listening, please don't sue us. We don't have any money.
Listen, what are you going to do to me now? Who pays this out of the look?
Yeah, you're free now. All right. Thanks again, Ron. And thank you so much for, thank Becky for lending you to us for all this time. We really appreciate it. And hopefully we'll be able to chat again soon.
I'd love it. And thanks a lot for having me on, guys.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
The secular jihadists have been made possible thanks to the gracious support of the Illuminati and the great state of Israel. That's what we have been told, but we haven't received our checks yet. In the meantime, we greatly appreciate the support of our current donors. please consider supporting by sharing the podcast with your fellow heathens or by donating at patreon.com/SJME.